Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says world powers are united in the search for an Iran nuclear deal. U.S. President Barack Obama's expected action on immigration sparks a fierce congressional debate.
We have a broken immigration system, and they refuse to act.
A look at efforts to save the world's forests. It's all ahead. I'm Frances Alonso. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says world powers are united in their search for an agreement on Iran's nuclear program as the deadline nears for a decision on a comprehensive accord. Kerry said, however, that officials want an agreement, but not just any agreement. He spoke after meeting Thursday in Paris with the foreign ministers of France and Saudi Arabia.
Both sides are taking this process seriously, and both sides are trying to find the common ground. That doesn't mean that we agree on everything. Obviously, there are gaps. We don't yet. But it does mean that we have discussed in detail the full range of relevant issues that have to be part of a durable and comprehensive agreement, including infrastructure, stockpiles, research, equipment, timing, and sequencing. And I would also emphasize that we all know our principles in this process. And our principles as a group are rock solid. As we have said every single step of this process, an agreement like the one we are seeking is not built on trust, as much as anybody might like it to be. It is built on verification. And no member of the P5 plus one is prepared to or can accept any arrangements that we cannot verify or make any promises that cannot be kept.
Later today, Kerry travels to Vienna to join high-level talks with Iran and a group that includes the U.S., Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany. They've been trying for a year to reach an agreement with the deadline on Monday. On the eve of President Barack Obama's expected announcement of executive action on immigration reform, passions on the issue are running high on Capitol Hill. VOA's Michael Bowman reports from the Senate, where lawmakers fiercely debated the wisdom and legality of presidential action, bypassing Congress to shield millions of undocumented immigrants from deportation.
The mere whisper of an imminent executive order to address America's immigration challenges had senators scrambling to the chamber floor to stake out positions and draw battle lines. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas said President Obama is not entitled to act on his own.
Most Americans will correctly view this as an abuse of power. An abuse of power. His unilateral action, which is unconstitutional and illegal, will be deeply harmful to our nation's tradition of the rule of law.
The president insists he is only acting in the absence of Congress passing any legislation whatsoever to reform America's much-criticized immigration system. That point was echoed by Democratic Senator Richard Durbin, who noted that the only immigration reform bill to pass either chamber in more than a decade, a comprehensive Senate bill approved last year, has gone nowhere in the House.
The Republican-led House of Representatives has not only failed to have a hearing on this bill, has refused to bring this bill to the floor, has refused to bring any immigration bill to the floor. They refuse to address the obvious. We have a broken immigration system, and they refuse to act.
President Obama is expected to defer deportations for millions of foreign-born citizens living illegally in the United States who have U.S.-born children. Such a move would prevent families from being split apart, but would fall short of the comprehensive overhaul of U.S. immigration laws most lawmakers say is needed. Only Congress can change federal law. Republicans like Senator Cornyn say an overhaul is still possible, but not if Mr. Obama short-circuits the political process by acting on his own.
The message is that the president has given and our Democratic friends has given is we give up. We're not going to do our job as legislators. We're going to let the president, with the stroke of a pen, provide an executive amnesty to millions of people.
Not so, according to Democrat Richard Durbin, who notes that Mr. Obama would not be the first president to act on immigration.
Every president of the United States since Dwight David Eisenhower has used his executive authority to improve our immigration system by executive order. Every single one of them. President George H.W. Bush issued a family fairness policy allowing 1.5 million people in America to apply for deferred action and work permits. It's clear the presidents have the authority to do this.
Which side is correct? That may be left to the judiciary to decide, as Republicans have promised to challenge any executive order on immigration in federal court. For now, all eyes in the debate are on the White House, where President Obama has the next move. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
North Korea today threatened to carry out a fresh nuclear test in response to a UN committee's condemnation of Pyongyang's alleged human rights abuses. Shannon Van Zandt reports from Beijing.
The North Korea threat came after the United Nations moved to bring the country before the International Criminal Court, or the ICC, for crimes against humanity earlier this week. On Thursday, China's foreign ministry spokesperson urged all parties to return to dialogue and the six-party talks. Hong Lei said differences on human rights issues should be resolved by all countries via dialogue. He said China's position is to maintain stability on the peninsula and resolve issues through dialogue. The UN Human Rights Committee passed a resolution on Tuesday calling for a probe of the country's human rights violations. China voted against the resolution and will likely veto moves to refer North Korea to the ICC. China has been a longtime ally of North Korea and returns North Korean refugees who are caught fleeing across their shared border. Many of these refugees say they are fleeing what the UN described in a report earlier this year as unspeakable atrocities. The UN has detailed the use of labor camps, torture, rape, and abductions by the North Korean government. North Korea has called these allegations a political provocation and said the UN resolution was based on fabricated testimonies from North Korean defectors. Today, North Korea released a statement on government-run television. The North Korean newsreader said that the U.S. hostile policy toward the Democratic People's Republic of Korea compels North Korea to not refrain any longer from conducting a new nuclear test. The reader said the principal architect of the U.N. resolution and their colleagues will be held wholly responsible for all the consequences of the resolution's adoption. Several American research institutes cite evidence that North Korea is preparing for a nuclear test. Johns Hopkins University's U.S.-Korea Institute at SAIS reports of a recent reactor shutdown in North Korea. The Institute for Science and International Security has also said satellite imagery shows a reactor shutdown. And the U.S.-Korea Institute reported other evidence, including truck activity near the reactor site. North Korea conducted an atomic bomb test in 2006, 2009, and 2013. The country last reprocessed spent fuel in 2009 before conducting its second nuclear test. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
Iraq is reporting gains against Islamic State jihadists in Anbar province, with Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi saying that the government has retaken the initiative militarily. He spoke at a Baghdad news conference with Turkey's prime minister. For VOA, Edward Uranian has more from Cairo.
Iraqi state TV reports that government security forces in Anbar have recaptured several villages near the provincial capital Ramadi and are trying to retake the town of Heat, which fell to Islamic State militants last month. The militants reportedly killed hundreds of members of the Al-Bunimr tribe in and around Heat last month after they were forced to surrender to the militants. The killings, which were documented in photographs and amateur videos, shocked other Sunni tribes in the region and turned many against the jihadist group. During a visit by Turkish Prime Minister Ahmed Davutoglu to Baghdad Thursday, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi told reporters that government forces have retaken the military initiative. He says that just recently Baghdad itself was threatened by the Islamic State, but now the battle has been taken to other, more distant places, with government forces having just recaptured the town of Beji and its refinery, along with the highway to Baghdad. He adds that the government forces are now in the process of retaking parts of Anbar province, along with territory in Diyala, Salahuddin, and Nineveh provinces. Mr. Abadi also thanked the Turkish prime minister for an offer to help the Iraqi government in its battle against the Islamic State group. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, however, said in his speech in Ankara that the United States had not fulfilled what he called necessary conditions for Turkish participation in the coalition against the Islamic State. Sky News Arabia reported that a coalition airstrike killed Radwan Hamdoun, whom it called the Islamic State's Minister of War. It said the strike took place near the city of Mosul, which is now under Islamic State control. Iraqi State TV reported that 70 Islamic State militants were also killed in a strike near Kirkuk. Iraqi TV called on residents of Heat to remain in their houses while the operation to liberate the area takes place. It reported that the town of Dulab and nearby villages had been liberated. Former Iraqi National Security Advisor Dr. Muafiq Arubai tells VOA that Iraqi government forces have managed to turn the tables against the Islamic State within the last 6 to 8 weeks and have managed to contain their momentum and progress. Iraqi security forces have the upper hand now, he said, adding, now, with the help from the international community, especially the United States of America, we're managing to roll them back and to hopefully defeat them and ultimately destroy them. U.S. President Barack Obama has sent 3,500 military advisors to Iraq to help Iraqi security forces counter the Islamic State. The U.S., Britain, and France are also participating in airstrikes against Islamic State targets, along with Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A United Nations commission is looking into allegations of widespread and systematic violations by Eritrean authorities against the country's citizens. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 6,000 Eritreans have fled to Ethiopia over the past month for fear of being recruited into the National Army. The agency recently said the number of Eritreans seeking asylum in Europe has tripled this year. The chairman of the commission, Mike Smith, says those numbers are a sign something is seriously wrong.
That, of course, is a symptom of what we're trying to look at. These people are leaving their country for a reason, and people don't put themselves at risk and go through the sorts of traumas which a lot of these people are doing, and to the risk of being exploited by people traffickers and so on, and travelling in unsafe boats across the Mediterranean without having some sort of a reason behind it.
One of the commission members is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights Situation in Eritrea, Sheila Keita Root. The Mauritian lawyer and human rights advocate has presented two reports to the UN Human Rights Council condemning gross violations in Eritrea. Nevertheless, she and the other two members, independent experts from Australia and Ghana, say they will approach their job in an independent and impartial way. The commission has sent a letter to the Eritrean government and has met with representatives at the UN mission in Geneva, requesting permission to enter the country to carry out its investigation. Smith tells VOA the group has not yet received a response to its request. He says it would be a good sign were the government to grant permission.
If they were to agree for us to come in, it would indicate, importantly, that they were prepared to address some of these problems, and I think that would be a very positive thing. And were we to get in there, we would be talking about the sorts of steps that would need to be taken to rectify any human rights problems that we identify.
Smith says the commission has not yet firmed up all the places where it will go to gather information. He adds the commission would like to go where there are substantial numbers of Eritrean asylum seekers. The UN Human Rights Council established the Commission of Inquiry in Eritrea in June to investigate a variety of alleged violations. These include extrajudicial killings, enforced disappearances, arbitrary arrests, torture, restrictions to civil liberties, human trafficking, discrimination against women, and sexual and gender-based violence. The Commission will report orally on its findings to the Council in March. A final report will be presented in June. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The international human rights group Amnesty International says the world community's failure to deal with the growing number of Syrian refugees fleeing into Turkey has led to a crisis of unprecedented proportions. In a report released today in London, Amnesty says refugees face pushbacks and live fire at the border and hundreds of thousands of lives in destitution. Sayla Hennessy reports from London that analysts are raising new concerns about the refugees as winter approaches.
Turkey hosts more than 500,000 Syrian refugees, around half of the total number of Syrians who have fled their war-ravaged country since 2011. Turkey says it has spent $4 billion to help the refugees, and Amnesty is quick to praise the country for shouldering so much of the crisis. But it says refugees are facing serious human rights risks. Amnesty's Anna Shia says one of the main problems is the shortage of official crossing points where refugees can enter Turkey from Syria.
There are only two fully open and operational border crossings along Turkey's 900-kilometer long border with Syria. So people have to travel through dangerous territories, and probably the most vulnerable people are not even able to leave Syria.
The Amnesty report says many Syrians are turned away at those crossing points if they're not carrying a passport. Many Syrians instead attempt to cross at irregular crossing points.
Once people do reach these irregular crossings, they have to use the services of smugglers very often. And as our research documents, they face a risk of abuse by Turkish border guards.
Amnesty says at least 17 people have been killed by border guards using live ammunition at unofficial crossing points between December 2013 and August 2014. The human rights group says many others have been beaten and pushed back into Syria. Anna Oprison, a development expert from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, says for those who do manage to enter Turkey, the living conditions are poor. Only 220,000 refugees are living in well-resourced camps. The remaining 1.3 million are fending for themselves. Oprison describes seeing whole families living in tents that have been erected on rooftops and watching children running around barefoot in freezing weather.
Winter came already. In certain areas of Turkey, it already snowed, if you ask me. So living in a tent is not a proper condition to survive in. And also, it's not only the winter, it's the fact that the basic needs also, no food, no nothing, no possibility to actually work.
Amnesty says the international community has to do more to help the situation. According to Turkey, only 15% of refugees living outside official camps receive assistance from humanitarian agencies and organizations.
Is the response of the international community to the Syrian refugee crisis, which has been nothing short of shameful? The funding commitments are appallingly low.
The United Nations earmarked just under $500 million for Turkey in its 2014 regional funding appeal for Syrians. According to Amnesty International, up until October 2014, only 28% of that has been committed by international donors. Sayla Hennessy for VOA News, London.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Protecting the world's forest is promoted as a way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But some researchers say conserving forests alone will not significantly reduce emissions. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
It's estimated that protecting forests could prevent 77 billion tons of carbon dioxide from entering the atmosphere by the year 2100. Researcher Alexander Popp says protecting forests to abate climate change is definitely worthwhile.
Avoiding deforestation in general is a very important aspect, first of all in terms of carbon emissions avoidance, but also from other perspectives like biodiversity conservation, local livelihoods, or local climate aspects.
Popp is group leader on land use management at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. He says while preventing deforestation does have beneficial effects, there can be consequences if that's all that's done.
Indeed, emissions are reduced, but what we could observe is that there are now new emissions occurring from kind of leakage effect, displacement effect.
In other words, preserving forests means other types of land would be used to grow crops instead. Popp says that would result in environmental losses.
Loss of non-forest ecosystems that also have a high carbon content in the soils, in the vegetation, like wetland savannas, for example, in Africa, or grasslands, and also have a high biodiversity content.
High biodiversity content means lots of plant and animal species. Current climate change negotiations include something called RED, or reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation. But Popp says it only focuses on protecting forests. He says that the largest benefits for climate change mitigation could be achieved by a forest conservation scheme and the inclusion of other land types with high carbon content.
We did big computer simulations, and we looked at three different potential future land use worlds. One scenario without any carbon conservation, one with avoided deforestation only, and one with conservation of all land use types that have high carbon content.
The all-inclusive model yielded the greatest carbon benefits and protected biodiversity. But if a wide variety of land is protected, how does agricultural production increase to feed a rapidly growing global population? Popp says one way is to boost yields on existing farmland.
In sub-Saharan Africa, there's much more potential for agricultural yields that we currently observe, and therefore much more potential for agricultural production. If these potential yields could be catched up compared to the current yields we observe today, and improved smallholder farm management, that would be an added value in terms of taking the pressure from the land and therefore decreasing agricultural expansion.
Another way to meet future food needs, he says, is by reducing waste in agricultural production. Much food is lost through poor harvesting methods and lack of proper storage and transportation. Also, studies have shown billions of dollars worth of food is wasted every year in developed countries. For example, the Natural Resources Defense Council has estimated that 40% of food in the United States goes uneaten, the equivalent of $165 billion a year. It says the food then rots in landfills, adding another greenhouse gas to the atmosphere, methane. Livestock production in developed countries, he says, also uses a lot of resources. It also produces a lot of methane. Popp says if demand for agricultural commodities is reduced by cutting waste and making agriculture more efficient, there would be less demand for land use.
By decreasing the production levels that are needed from the land, there automatically would be a decrease in the pressure on the land and therefore less expansion of agricultural production into unused land like forests or other natural land would happen.
Given the lack of progress made in climate change negotiations, Popp and his colleagues doubt their comprehensive approach will be adopted now. They say a more achievable approach may be to protect non-forest areas that can store a lot of carbon and have good biodiversity. The RED plan, they say, would have to be altered so funds can go to programs not related to forests. The next climate change conference takes place in Lima, Peru, known as COP20, or Conference of Parties. The meeting runs from December 1st to the 12th. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis of global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.